It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to Republican Representative Sean Duffy as part of our series of candidate interviews. He's running for re-election in northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. First news broke yesterday that pipe bombs had been sent to prominent Democrats, including former President Barack Obama, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, former Vice President Joe Biden, along with other Democratic politicians. CNN was also evacuated for a similar package containing an explosive device. All of the suspicious packages were intercepted before they made it to their intended targets, and now there's a nationwide search underway to find the culprit. But the fact that multiple devices were sent to high-profile critics of President Trump and recipients of his criticism have people asking whether political rhetoric may be encouraging people to commit violent acts. Our next guest is here to talk about the divisive speech in politics and what can be done to calm things down. Don Hader-Markle is a professor and chair of political science at the University of Kansas. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, with the qualification that we don't know who's behind these attacks or what their motivation was, do you see a connection, big picture, between heated political rhetoric and threats or actual acts of violence?
Well, I think that rhetoric is taking place in the context of, obviously, we have a very divided and politically polarized country. So it's more that rhetoric and inflammatory speech, the derogatory language against political opponents and painting them as enemies in this particular context is more dangerous than it might be in another context.
Why is that?
I think the basic fact of the matter is there are always people out there that we can label as political extremists. And some of those people in some moments may be incited to act on those beliefs and engage in violence against what they perceive as their enemies. And the speech itself then basically helps lead them to the conclusion that their elected leaders, their public officials that can't act on these beliefs need somebody to act for them, and they're willing to take those steps.
I want to give a listen to President Trump. He responded yesterday afternoon to these pipe bombs in the mail, saying there was no place for this kind of activity. Speaking in Wisconsin last night, campaigning for Republicans ahead of the midterm election, he acknowledged the news. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
It's one way to settle our disagreements. It's called peacefully at the ballot box. That's what we want. That's what we want. As part of a larger national effort to bridge our divides and bring people together, the media also has a responsibility to set a civil tone and to stop the endless hostility and constant negative and oftentimes false attacks and stories. Have to do it. Have to do it. They've got to stop. Bring people together.
Do you see, Don, a role for the media in trying to dial down divisive rhetoric?
Honestly, I find his comments a little confusing since he's the one who tends to dial things up. You know, the media certainly has a role to play in all of this in reporting on the facts and maintaining a civil tone, and I guess I would argue that much of the mainstream media has been able to effectively do that in a time of divisive politics. There have, of course, been moments where the news media has done things that were inappropriate, but to turn to the media as the culprit behind this or even as a major motivator behind this, I think, would be silly. We could certainly turn to media such as social media and the sort of narrowcasting echo chambers that people can place themselves in, including with conspiracy theories, that helps motivate people to think there are really horrible things happening in the world and they have to take action.
This isn't the only act of political violence we've seen recently. There was the shooting last summer, the summer of last year, specifically targeting Republicans at a baseball practice. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders answered questions from reporters today and had this to say about last year's incident in relation to this week's news.
The president is certainly not responsible for sending suspicious packages to someone, no more than Bernie Sanders was responsible for a supporter of his shooting up a Republican baseball field practice last year. The idea that this is at the hands of the president is absolutely ridiculous.
Don, what do you say to that? Is there a difference, or are these part of our the same sort of divisive political landscape?
I really don't like to get into the debate about the sort of whataboutism, but I would point specifically to the fact that Trump is willing to use language to dehumanize and belittle his enemies and praise those who use physical violence against the news media or protesters and things like that. And that's not something, at least I understand, Bernie Sanders would be willing to do.
Talking to Don Hader-Markle, professor and chair of political science at the University of Kansas, looking at this week's pipe bomb incidents mailed to a number of Democratic leaders, a liberal donor, and CNN, so far Robert De Niro as well. Don, have we been here before? Have we seen comparable moments in American history and comparable attacks and threats in American history?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you can even go back to as recently as the anthrax mailings in 2001. You know, and although there are problems with the way that investigation was conducted, that was certainly politically motivated. And of course, if we go back earlier into the 1980s and 1970s and 1960s, we can find examples of both right-wing and left-wing political extremists who target their opponents. They're just not typically as these high-profile kind of persons that were targeted here.
Do we have examples from the past of leadership, whether it's from a president or other public figures, that can effectively tone things down, send out a message that people listen to, maybe the people who agree with them, people who don't, a message that this isn't the way to do politics?
I don't think it's one single message that can do it. I think it has to be an actual change in tone that's consistent over time. And as we've seen with the president last night and this morning, that tone hasn't really changed much. We have the one statement and then the tone doesn't change. And the overall tone is what is going to have the lastest longing effect rather than simply one statement that the president makes.
What kind of statement or what kind of, I guess, tone would you like to see from President Trump and from leaders of both parties?
So I think on both sides that the painting your political opponents as enemies or as evil is just not going to be a way to tone things down. The simple fact of the matter is people disagree on political issues. We may disagree or find some of the decisions that are made by our political opponents as negative, but it doesn't mean that we should simply paint them as evil or try to dehumanize them, because that's what paves the way for political violence.
We'll bring on a caller. Tracy is with us in Green Bay. Tracy, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I think that Trump's ongoing rhetoric when he discusses the Democratic Party and calling them a mob just calls for the extremist groups to come out with these kinds of activities like sending bombs. And so I guess I want to agree with your guest, and I think that that particular comment of his stated over and over again, while he isn't responsible, doesn't make him responsible for these acts, I think certainly calls into question his judgment with regards to how he's running things.
Tracy, thanks for the call. Do you see this changing anytime soon, Don?
Honestly, I don't. I mean, with the election just around the corner, if anything, I expect things will continue to heat up. The way, I think, as your caller pointed out, the way Democrats are being painted as a mob and not as sort of a faceless, personless mob helps in that process of dehumanizing. But also in talking about potential refugees that are trying to reach the United States in this caravan that's in Central America, literally describing them as this sort of incoming tide of humans that somehow are faceless and threatening to the rest of us, I think is this invoking fear is a strategy of the president and becoming a broader strategy with Republican candidates that are on the ballot this November.
And Don, as we start to wrap up, we've got a fairly dramatic incident, these bombs being mailed to a bunch of prominent political figures, media institutions, and elsewhere. I've seen some arguments that, hey, media don't overcover this. You're just you're rewarding the perpetrator, in effect, by giving this all that attention. What do you make of that line of thinking?
Well, I would think it deserves some coverage. There is a real security concern here. I think it remains to be seen how dangerous these devices really are, and were they really sort of set to go off if you opened a package, or are they just really rudimentary devices that basically almost anyone could make with plans off the internet? I think that's one factor, but until we have that full information, it seems like a reasonable story for the news media to cover.
We'll leave it there for now. Don, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Don Hader-Markle is a professor and chair of political science at the University of Kansas. He was with us to talk about political rhetoric and whether or not it's encouraging people to commit acts of violence. Between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today we talked to Sean Duffy. He's a Republican and the incumbent congressman representing Wisconsin's 7th congressional district seat, which serves northern Wisconsin. Also in that race, independent Ken Dreesen and Democratic candidate Margaret Engebritsen. Representative Duffy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on. It's good to be with you. I apologize my voice. I have a bit of a cold, but beyond that, doing well.
There's a lot going around lately. You are not alone. So what do you think is the most important issue facing your constituents there in Wisconsin's 7th District?
Well, there's a whole slew of issues that people are talking about. One, they're talking about the economy and jobs. They're talking about security of the southern border, health care. We're also talking about trade deals and tariffs. I think those are probably the four issues that I hear the most about on a continuous basis.
Well, let's start with those tariffs. There's been some concern lately about the impact of tariffs on Wisconsin manufacturers and farmers, too, for that matter. What direction do you want to see the federal government take when it comes to trade policy?
Well, I believe in free trade, but free trade has to be fair trade. And when you have countries around the world that have tariffs and non-tariff barriers on American manufactured or produced goods, but we have an open market for their manufactured and produced goods, that's not fair. And so we're forced to compete in the world with one hand tied behind our back. And I appreciate the president actually fighting to make sure Canada and Mexico, as well as Europe and especially China, treat our goods like we treat their goods. And, you know, specifically with China, you know, the president has asked China to do two things. They said, listen, we want you to stop stealing our intellectual property, number one, and number two, treat our goods the way we treat your goods. Stop putting all these tariffs on American manufactured goods. And to that, the Chinese have said no. And the president said, okay, well, I'm going to retaliate and push back on you, China, until you be a more free and open market. You just can't take advantage of us like that. And in the long run, this is going to be better for the American worker. This is a long-term play, making sure that we can continue to have great jobs that pay our families well because we make great products here that we can sell around the world, and barriers don't shut our goods out, not because we don't make the best products or the best priced products, but because they put tariffs on our products.
A lot of people I've talked to have said, okay, yeah, China, that's one thing. They're doing a lot of things wrong with, and they're kind of trading rivals. With trading partners and allies like Canada, the EU, Mexico, sure, there's disagreements. We should be negotiating, not having these escalating tariff battles. Do you worry we're getting into too much of a confrontational relationship there?
Well, first of all, if you could just negotiate nicely and say, hey, this isn't fair, will you treat us fairly? If that was the case, we could have done this 20 years ago. But that's not the case. Until you push these other countries, they're not going to give up the benefit they have in their trade with the United States of America. The conversation didn't work. And so, I mean, if you look at, you know, Canada, they're allegedly a great friend of ours, but in trade, not so much. We saw it happen when Grassland Dairy lost their markets in Canada. Over 70 farms didn't have a home to sell their milk anymore. I mean, it had a huge impact on our dairy. That's because they've closed off their market to a lot of our dairy products. And the president could have cut a deal with NAFTA a lot earlier, but he was holding out to cut a better deal for American dairy, and specifically Wisconsin dairy, and I'm grateful for that. It's not perfect, but we have a better deal today than we did before the president renegotiated NAFTA. We have a better deal with Canada in regard to dairy.
You also mentioned immigration as a top priority. This has been a long-running issue. Congress has tried and not come up with solutions to a lot of the contentious issues out there. What would you be advocating for in another term in Congress when it comes to immigration?
So I would tell you that we actually have a lot of bipartisan support. I know I'm going to shock your listeners on this, but the sides are not that far apart. I think the answer is pretty simple. One, you need to secure your border, whether part of it's with a wall or with technology, however you want to do it, you got to secure your border. We have to deal with the people who are in our country and working, who, you know, go to church. They work 40 plus hours a week. They shop at Walmart. They're good folks. Find a way to give them a path to a legal status. Deal with the DACA kids. If you want, give them a path to citizenship. And then what we have to do is allow far more work visas so we can let people come into the country and meet the demands of our economy that aren't being met by the American worker. And by the way, when we don't have unemployment that's so low and it actually starts to tick back up again because economies are cyclical, those workers will move back out of the country and those jobs will remain for American families. And then you have to have some type of internal verification system like E-Verify. So you can bring people in, but you got to verify that people are also here in the workforce working legally. And so then instead of having, 4,000 or 7,000 people coming across the Mexican desert and, you see the pictures, they're horrible of the plight of the march. People can get on a plane and they can fly. They can fly to Madison or Duluth or Wausau and, take up a job that another American doesn't want. I think this is the most rational approach. And there's a lot of Democrats and Republicans that agree to this approach. There's some tweaks around the edges that we have to fix. But I think this is the simplest and easiest way to, in the long run, deal with this problem. And just one other point. Then what you have is those who are coming across the border unlawfully, they're people who, they're running guns or drugs or illegal guns. Just one other point, too, is as we deal with this crisis of drugs, of meth and heroin, virtually all those drugs are coming across the southern border. Securing that border and doing our best to keep those drugs out, I think, is incredibly important in our new fight to get these drugs that are devastating our communities and our families and kids, getting them under control.
Talking to Sean Duffy, Republican incumbent in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District in our series of candidate interviews for the November elections. Let's turn to the deficit. It's gone up this year. It's the 8th year or so of this recovery from the Great Recession. People like to see deficits go down around this time. What are your thoughts on the causes and cures for the federal deficit?
Yeah, it's a big issue. So $21-plus trillion in debt. I think there's two things that have to happen. One, you have to continue to grow your economy like we are right now, and you have to cap your spending. You don't have to cut spending. You just have to stop it from growing. Just cap it. You do those two things, and we're going to be able to get our debt right-sized. The problem is the federal government continues to spend more money. But I will note that if you look at the revenue side, even with the tax cuts that gave great tax breaks to everybody who pays taxes are paying now less taxes. If you don't pay any taxes, you don't get a tax break. But, every family on average, is going to save over $2,000 a year in Wisconsin. Actually, more revenue is going into the federal coffers from individuals because they're making more money and more people are actually working. The revenue from corporations to the federal coffers has gone down. And I think that was expected as you now start to see corporations bringing more of their business back. They're bringing their money back. And President Trump mentioned this last night that Apple is bringing back $350 billion from overseas and investing it here in America. When those investments take place in the out quarters, you're going to see that revenue continue to increase to the federal coffers because of growth and reinvestment from corporations.
I want to get to health care, another issue you mentioned important in your district. A lot of people talking about this now. What do you want to see when it comes to federal health care policy?
So I believe that our family, I don't believe in the Medicare for all model. I think that what you do with the Bernie Sanders model is you take Medicare away from seniors, you take TRICARE away from our veterans. You take everyone's individual plan, whether it's employer-sponsored or their own plans, and you put them all into a government plan it costs $32 trillion over 10 years. I don't think that's the right approach. I think a model that incentivizes families to pick plans that fit the needs that and risks that they have in their life at prices that they can afford, making hospitals and doctors and clinics and insurance companies competing for your business is the best pathway forward. And then making sure we have a system to take care of the poorest members of our community, also making sure you have high-risk pools that make insurance affordable for people with pre-existing conditions. I think that's the best model. But I'm a realist. If you look at the politics today, the parties have gone, and then America has gone, in polar opposite directions. And I don't see a pathway to move forward from the place that we're at right now, where healthcare works really well if you're rich. And it works pretty well if you're poor because you get a lot of subsidies. But there's a lot of middle-income people who are, for a family of four paying $1,800 a month with a $7,000 deductible, and prices are going up even further. So here's what I think we do. I think we say, listen, we'll call a truce, liberals and conservatives. Let's give the money back to the states. The federal money, give it back to the states. We'll have probably a little argument about how you do it. You do it on size or poverty. But equally and fairly divide up the money, give it back to the states. And if California wants to do a single-payer government-run healthcare system, and so too does New York, great. And if, Texas and, Michigan and Montana and Wisconsin want to try a more free enterprise system, they can try that too. You would have 50 different models of state-driven health care. And if I'm wrong and a single-payer model delivers a better health care product at a better price, I'll say I was wrong and they were right. And I think those who disagree with me might say, well, listen, our model didn't work and a more free enterprise model worked. Or there might be some creative states that do something different that is the answer.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Representative Sean Duffy, Republican running for re-election in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. We talked to the independent candidate in that race on Tuesday. We'll talk to the Democratic challenger tomorrow at this time. You can find all of these candidate interviews at wisconsinvote.org. I'm Rob Ferret. More to come on Central Time. It's the time of the year when the winds howl and the nights get longer, and as the chilly weather settles over the state, it's time for some old-fashioned ghost stories. Tales of faceless voices talking to families, haunted music boxes, and friendly ghosts helping with genealogical research. Wisconsin is chock full of spooky tales. Just in time for Halloween, our guest is here to share some ghost stories and talk about haunted sites around the state. Michael Norman is the author of a dozen books, including Haunted Wisconsin and Haunted Heartland. He's also a retired journalism professor at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you write in the preface to a later edition of your book on Haunted Wisconsin. You went in wondering, well, are there that many stories out there? Are people going to share the stories? You got an answer. They sure were, it sounds like.
Well, they did, and that was the main question that my late co-author and I had to answer when we decided to write a book of ghost stories, not fiction where we would make them up, but rather look around the countryside, around the state, and see if haunted Wisconsin was the most haunted state in the United States, had more ghosts per square mile than any other state, as Dr. Bob Gard claimed in one of his books of Wisconsin folklore.
I know there's no federal department of the paranormal, as far as we know, but do you buy that? Are we particularly haunted here in Wisconsin?
Oh, I don't know. I think that was a folklorist doing a little bit of exaggeration. I think you may find stories like this all over if you just go looking, and that's what we did. It was 38 years ago, actually, this Halloween, that the first edition came out. And, based on interviews, a lot of research, a lot of going into archives, because we found, for instance, that the 19th century, understandably, was just chock-a-block full of ghost stories. But that came from, people having to rely on their feet or horses' back or wagon to get any place through the wilderness.
And now you're looking to collect these stories in these books. You're not out to prove these happened or to debunk them or anything like that, right?
Exactly. I'm a ghost writer, not a ghost hunter. And we made that decision early on. What we wanted to do, and I continue to do now all these years later, is look at it from not precisely a journalistic or reporting standpoint, But from the standpoint of let's see what the facts are. What can we find out? You know, through interviews, through old-fashioned research, about the stories. A lot of them, we ended up not using because we weren't able to verify anything. And that applies to today. I hear a lot of stories that a certain intersection is haunted or a building is haunted. But then when you start, sort of chopping away, you can't confirm it in any way. And that is find somebody who has an actual incident or through other kinds of research.
And a funny thing happened between editions of the book. Some people will have what they think is a ghostly encounter, and then later on discover that you'd written about that location in the past. And somebody says, in that book, something like that happened here before.
Exactly. We've heard, from people who have added, a tale or a story has gone in. This is the third edition that came out a few years ago from the University of Wisconsin Press. So, it's been a long while, and individuals discover that an experience they had was something that was mirrored in the book. And so if it turned out to be appropriate, I included it.
Talking to Michael Norman, author of Haunted Wisconsin. We're getting some spooky stories from around the state leading up to Halloween. If you've got one, by the way, or in your home, in your community, a local legend, you can share it with us at 800-642-1234. Michael, I met you actually some years back. I was with the Joy Cardine Show. We did a show from River Falls, and I seem to recall you pointed out some UW River Falls campus folklore for us. Do you want to share one of those?
Yeah, there actually are a couple of stories from this campus. You find many colleges are replete with ghost stories. And on this particular campus, there's a story of a custodian who heard a basketball game going on in a part of the building where there should not have been anything going on. It was an old gym that hadn't been used in some time. And she went down to check things out, open the door. And there was a ghostly number of basketball players that just faded away and nearly scared her to death. There's a theater. The theater has a story connected to it about the ghost of a man who helped design the theater. And I heard that story from a theater professor who I finally was able to persuade to tell me the story of his encounter one night with a man who turned out to be, he thinks, the ghost of this particular individual. Mm. So, stories sometimes are all around you if you know, where to look. And also understand that sometimes people aren't real anxious to share the story, especially in a public way. There's still that feeling that, you've seen ghosts. It's like seeing UFOs or the Yeti or something.
You were going to share, I think, a couple stories from the book. Let's start with one, a good site for a ghost story, a graveyard. You've got one you headline, Do Not Disturb, in the book.
Yeah, this was an interesting story because it came to me from the man involved in the story, who was the central character in the story, some years ago. And it stretches all the way back to the 1930s. Do you have time for a short...
Yeah.
Reading
it's Halloween. We want a little ghost story.
Well, the story goes, old Teddy King grunted and sweated as he dug into the Knapp Cemetery plot that held his mother's coffin. With each swing of his shovel, Teddy slowly cleared away nearly 30 years of dirt and stone so that he could move his mother's remains to another graveyard. It was late August, 1936. St. Croix County officials had ordered the graves moved. A new road was going to be built, and the county needed the cemetery as part of the right-of-way. Most of the remains had been transferred earlier in the month. Mrs. King was the last one to leave. The old man rustled the moldy casket into a makeshift wheelbarrow and set off down the road. Now, watching all this was one Lloyd Owens, a young man who was working that summer at the Al Larson farm, just crossways from the cemetery. Curiosity is the compelling affliction of the young. That's what persuaded Lloyd to cross the road to Mrs. King's empty grave. He shivered as he looked down into the damp hole. As he poked around in the fresh dirt with the toe of his boot, something shiny caught his eye. Lloyd picked it up, cleaned it off, and held it up to the fading sunlight. It was a pink glass coffin handle. It came from Mrs. King's coffin, he thought. I'll give it to Teddy next time I see him in town. He stuffed the object in the pocket of his bib overalls and trotted back to the Larson house and on up to his room. He put the handle on the top of his dresser. Lloyd did not sleep well that night. I'll leave it there.
Sure. So give us the story of what happened next to Lloyd. That was a good tease for the story there. He ultimately decided he ought to return this thing, right? What happened to him between?
It kept moving, shall we say. I don't want to give away the story.
Sure. Okay.
Point here. It didn't stay put. And in fact, not long ago, someone said that reminded them of the movie Poltergeist. You know, you should not disturb someone's grave. And that's kind of a common motif.
Now, do you get a lot of stories from people related to graves and cemeteries?
Yes. And actually, very few stories that I've ended up including in any of my books take place in cemeteries. I think that in order for life maybe to take place in ghostly form, it has to occur at a place where there was life during during a lifetime. And cemeteries can be kind of scary places, but at the same time, in Europe, graveyards are used for picnics. So I think it depends on your attitude.
We're talking to Michael Norman. He's the author of a dozen books, including Haunted Wisconsin and Haunted Heartland. He's also a retired journalism professor at UW River Falls. He's with us to talk about haunted sites in Wisconsin and local ghost stories. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a haunted story you'd like to share, or do you have a question about local Wisconsin hauntings? Is there a legend in your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about Wisconsin ghost stories with Michael Norman. He's the author of a dozen books, including Haunted Wisconsin. He's a professor emeritus of journalism at UW River Falls, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does your family, does your town have a ghost story of its own? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Roger is with us in La Crosse. Roger, hi. What do you got for us?
Hi, yeah. So when I was a teenager, I grew up in Wapaka, Wisconsin, and there's a nearby town, Wyawega, and there's this gravel road called Marsh Road, and on either side of the road is just swamp. And there was this legend that right at the end of the road, there's a house. I think there's one house on the whole road, and then it's just swamp. And there was a legend that this farmer lived in a house, and he had this prized albino goat. And this road is also a popular party spot for kids. And some kids were driving down the road, and they hit his goat. And he tracked them down. They just went down the road to party and killed them all and killed himself. So the legend was, if you're driving down this road reckless and you turn your lights on and off three times, a goat will appear in front of your car. You'll run off the road into the swamp, and this farmer, his spear will come and kill you. So me and my buddy were driving down the road. We knew about the legend. I kept trying to tell him, turn your lights, do it. And he's like, no. So I reached over and turned his lights off, and he turned them back on. I'm like, all right, we did it once. You got to do it twice now. So he turned them off and on, turned them off. And when he turned them on again, there was a deer in front of us. It scared the crap out of me. I jumped across, hit his arm. He swerved. We went into the ditch. And we were just sitting there freaking out. Like, you got to get out. No, you got to get out. Check this out.
Well, I'm glad you lived to tell the tale, Roger. Maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy there. I don't know. Michael, are there a lot of stories like this? Like, if you go into this building or this street, you do this thing, the ghost, goat or otherwise, will appear?
Sure. You find quite a few like that. And first, a goat I've heard about. So Those are common. The one that's most often heard is a variation of the hook. The coupled out, kissing and whatnot in the car, and they have the radio on low. I guess that's when there were radios in cars. A news bulletin comes on that an escaped convict, is on the loose. Be careful. Watch yourself. Don't go parking in, lovers' lanes because, he could be dangerous. And he's known for the fact that his right hand is a hook. They hear something scratching at the outside of the car. They take off, get to her house, and they find the hook stuck in the door. That's kind of the common motif like that. I think, many of these stories are created maybe to either warn young people, stay on the straight and narrow, or to stay away from someplace. It's hard. If it sounds like there's some facts, connected to it, it's pretty easy to track down. If you want to, maybe you want to stick with the legend and not, track down the truth of the. If there was a mass murder, some guy killed his children, that surely made the newspapers sometime.
All right, Roger, you can live with a legend or try to track it down. We'll go next to Wanda in Fond du Lac. Wanda, hello.
Hi. Yeah, me and my husband, well this is in Fond du Lac at the train station. There's an old train station there, and my husband and I, neither of us believe in ghosts, whatever. There's one guy doing paperwork. It's a real long building, and it was a furniture store. So we were looking for, I don't remember what, but we were walking, it's just a hallway down the middle and furniture on both sides. We get all the way to the end and had to turn around. And when we turned around, there was a heavy, a heavy chair right in the middle of the hallway. I mean, you literally can look the whole way down the station, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
There was nobody there, absolutely nobody. Me and him looked at each other. We stepped over the chair. And needless to say, we never bought furniture there.
You don't want the haunted furniture. And, Michael, there's a lot of stories in your book of ghosts who do little things, not necessarily helpful, not necessarily harmful. They just, people say, make their presence known, I guess, like the old train station furniture ghost.
Right, exactly. They move furniture around. They cause a rocker to rock, that sort of thing. Playful ghosts. If it is a ghost, unless somebody is actually playing a trick on you, many of these stories, if it goes on for a while, they talk about a poltergeist being a noisy ghost. And some of those are interesting that I was able to find, especially in the old days. There was one in particular from St. Croix County, Katy Township, in which a family was beset by poltergeists or things. Axes being thrown and clothing being cut up, to the extent that it was, reporters and editors from newspapers all around the region ended up showing up at this house waiting to see the poltergeist in action. That was great entertainment 100 years ago.
Thanks a lot for the call, Wanda. We'll go next to Jim with us in Madison. Jim, hi. Jim, are you there? We don't have Jim. Jim wanted to know if Whitewater was known as Salem Triangle. Have you heard a lot of stories in the Whitewater area, Michael?
I'm sorry, I didn't. Known as what?
Whitewater, known as the Salem Triangle. I guess like the Salem witch trials and whatnot. Have you do you have any stories from the Whitewater area?
That's Salem Triangle is a new one for me. Whitewater in the 19th century was very well known for its spiritualism. Being kind of a center of what at one time was called spiritualism, the spiritualist church, and has several of those. So maybe they grew out of that.
Interesting. We are talking to Michael Norman, author of Haunted Wisconsin, among other books, sharing some Wisconsin ghost stories this time of year. We'll go next to Ryan in Onalaska. Ryan, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ryan?
I witnessed the Highway 12 hitchhiker in his green slicker. I was driving from Black Earth, Wisconsin, up to the La Crosse area on Alaska, and it kind of blew my mind. But I didn't I didn't know about it until afterwards when I actually read the book.
All right, the Phantom Hitchhiker in the Baraboo area, Michael.
There are Phantom Hitchhikers all over. That's a very common motif. The one outside Baraboo, I'm not familiar with. I'll have to look into that.
All right, Ryan, thanks a lot for that call. But that idea of the hitchhiker, I mean, there's a great Twilight Zone episode that I can't think of too closely with a phantom hitchhiker in it. That's a story that comes up in different places, Michael?
Yes, absolutely. A phantom hitchhiker, there's always several versions of that. The Ridgeway Ghost is kind of a phantom hitchhiker type of thing, which is probably if people know a ghost story in Wisconsin, it's probably the Ridgeway Ghost in the southwestern part of the state. There are, you know, phantom hitchhikers. As I said, it's a common motif.
Tell us a little more about the Ridgeway Ghost.
Well, that's a ghost that goes back to the early 19th century. As I said, it's probably if people know a ghost story from Wisconsin, it's probably that one. I like it. It's a shapeshifter. It's a ghost that is said to change shapes, and including a goat. Sometimes it's seen as a goat,
Owl,
a pig, even a horse, as well as a human being. It's a story that has, I would say, dozens and dozens of variations to it, as over the years. It's in that area on, Highway 18 and 151 between Madison and Blue Mountains and Dodgeville, that area.
And Michael, in our last couple minutes, obviously there's something about us as humans that likes a ghost story. Whether we believe in the stories or not, we want to hear them. What is it? What is it about ghost stories that we find appealing, entertaining? What?
Well, I think it deals to a certain extent with a great unanswered question, and that is, what happens to us when we die? Is there a possibility that some part of us survives, spirit, form, something? I think that is maybe fundamentally the reason we enjoy them. I think we like being scared, but we only like being scared in the comfort of our own home or someplace where we are not real physical danger is not fun. Nobody wants to do that. But to sort of have that delightful shiver, is always a good idea. Or it's an idea that many of us enjoy doing that. But I think it's it could be entertaining. The stories, some individuals, that read my book say, well, these aren't horrible. Most ghost stories are not. I don't want to necessarily call them gentle ghosts, but horror rarely happens in a story that sounds like it could be true or it could be accurate. So I think those are a few of the reasons.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's been a delight.
That's Michael Norman. He's the author of a dozen books, including Haunted Wisconsin and Haunted Heartland. He's also a retired journalism professor at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. He joined us to talk about haunted sites in Wisconsin and share some local ghost stories around the state. You can still share your local legend over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Is there a ghost in your town? Last week, we talked to Grant Barrett from the show Away with Words about how new words enter the English language. Well, here's a little follow-up on that for your recreational enjoyment. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary now has a web service called Time Traveler. Here's the deal. You select the year you were born, or any year you want. They won't know. Then they give you a list of words and phrases that made their first known appearance in the English language that year. Disclaimer, it doesn't mean that the word was necessarily invented that year. It's just the earliest instance of that word in print. So let's play in my birth year. The words include punk rock, okay, za, as in short for pizza. I don't use that one. China syndrome, okay, that was a particular event. Microaggression, that's older than I would have thought. Granola, that's newer than I would have thought. I thought that went way back. Sphinx? Wait, I thought that was thousands of years old, but wait, it's Sphinx with a Y, and that's a particular cat breed. Yucky and newbie, which you see, that's I think of that as more of a internet term. Nope, it goes back. The list keeps going on and on. What's that? You didn't hear me say what year I was born? Haha, yeah. We will tweet that link. Oh, I didn't tell you, Bill. Can we find that and tweet that link? We are at Central Time WPR. You can play at home and let us know which word you were born with. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.